Executive.
Estate. Part 1 dealt with the subject of executive rule. Part 2 was entitled The Apparatus of Control. The number to call at WBAI is 212-209-2900. Again, 212-209-2900. And Michael Haskins, our engineer and WBAI announcer, will be there to handle the switchboard and take your calls. Again, 212-209-2900, and our subject is Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State. I'd like to refer to Tom Baldwin's important article that appeared on March 16, 2003, in the South Jersey News, a local paper for New Jersey people. It was it's a Gannett paper, and he is from the Gannett State Bureau in Trenton. Red alert. Red alert is the highest color-coded readiness against the so-called terror. You will be assumed by authorities, Baldwin writes, to be the enemy if you so much as venture outside your home. Now, Baldwin wasn't making this up. He was referring to the New Jersey anti-terror czar, Sid Casperson. He's the director of the Office of Counterterrorism. And Casperson had told Baldwin that, quote, the state is on top of it. A red alert, according to Casperson, tears away virtually all personal freedoms to move about and associate. Specifically, Casperson said, red means all non-critical functions cease. Non-critical would be almost all businesses except health-related, end quote. In other words, he added, quote, the state will restrict transportation and access to critical locations. You must adhere to the restrictions announced by authorities and prepare to evacuate if instructed. Stay alert for emergency messages. And the Casperson added finally in his interview with Baldwin, quote, the state police and emergency management people would take control over the highways. You literally are staying home, end quote. Now, this was issued in 2003 on the heels of the 2001. The Homeland Security Department issued a mandate to all the states to prepare for red alert and ask them, what will you do? And this is what New Jersey came back with. Stay home. Red alert. If you so much as venture out of the house, you are considered to be a terrorist. This is not far-fetched. This is actually happening here in the United States. Ralph?
Well, my code red was amplified not only for the state of New Jersey. On March 30th, 2003, Michael Collins of Scripps Howard News wrote an extended piece in which he set forth what it would in fact entail. Code red, the headline says, will trigger a virtual lockdown, shutting landmarks, grounding planes, stopping trains, and triggering war roadblocks across the country. National landmarks such as the Washington Monument, Ellis Island, the Gateway Arch in St. Louis, and equivalent landmarks in other parts of the country will be shut down. Planes will be grounded, trains will stop running, bridges and tunnels will be closed, U.S. borders will be sealed off, and roadblocks will be set up in every interstate and major highway. The United States was prepared to go into lockdown mode, and code red means that there is a severe risk of terrorist attack or that an attack is imminent. Quote, it essentially means you stop doing everything, said Dave McIntyre, deputy director of the AMSR Institute for Homeland Security, a so-called nonprofit research group in Arlington, Virginia. Now, what's significant not only about the Code Red discussions in 2003, which after all have been long set in motion by prior administrations, previous plans for martial law were addressed to Vietnam War protests, Iran-Contra was an arena in which all of these plans were put into effect in July 1983, and the San Francisco Examiner, the two-time Pulitzer Prize winner Knut Reuss, reported that a presidential directive had been prepared by Carter in 1979 for allowing the military to take control of the government. A caveat said keeping the government functioning will be a secret, costly project detractors claim jeopardizes U.S. traditions and saves a privileged few. But nonetheless, the Carter administration put these plans into motion. And of course, during Iran-Contra, even in the wake of all of the data about the scandal, what became clear is that FEMA under Oliver North had prepared for massive detention, mass roundups, and for the setting up of camps. In fact, the Miami Herald on July 5, 1987, ran a story which stipulated that the FEMA plans under Oliver North were preparing to arrest what was at that time called 21 million Negroes in the United States.
Ralph, people might say, well, it can't happen here. But only recently, July 2nd of this year, ABC News reporters Brian Ross, Rhonda Schwartz, Richard Esposito reported, quote, official sites resemblance to warnings and intelligence before 9/11. In the article that appeared on afterdowningstreet.org, the ABC reporters refer to a secret U.S. law enforcement report prepared for the Department of Homeland Security that warned that Al-Qaeda is planning a terror, quote, spectacular, end quote, this summer, that is, the summer of 2007. They got this information from a senior official with access to the document. The official, according to ABC, quote, this is reminiscent of the warnings and intelligence we were getting in the summer of 2001, end quote. ABC reporters go on to say that U.S. officials have kept the information secret, and Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff said, though, on ABC News with the program This Week with George Stephanopoulos, that the United States did not have specific credible evidence. However, despite what Chertoff says publicly on TV, what we have going on in the government is reports announcing a terror spectacular. And as ABC notes, that intelligence reports were received besides these reports. There have been, this is not the only one. Ralph.
Well, Maya, as I don't like quoting Wikipedia because, frankly, this is a discussion we'll have it at a future time on Taking Aim.
It's a tremendous source of disinformation.
It's not only a source of disinformation in general, but it is very often an avenue for Central Intelligence Agency disinformation on a regular and sustained basis. What passes for information in Wikipedia has to be looked at with a great deal of care, and that's a discussion we will have concretely. Notwithstanding that, evidence against interest is the criterion here, and on Wikipedia itself, it acknowledges that the martial law concept is closely tied with the writ of habeas corpus, which is, of course, the right to a hearing on lawful imprisonment or broadly the supervision of law enforcement by the judiciary. Suspending habeas corpus, in effect, it becomes equated with martial law. Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution says that the privilege of writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended. And it gives only cases of invasion when public safety might require it in limited instances. But notwithstanding these constitutional prohibitions, the most recent executive order of July 17th by Bush, President Bush, allows for the removal of property, the confiscation of property, the confiscation of anything from your house to your car to your clothes to your access to food, all elements of your functioning as a citizen or as a person on the basis of jeopardizing or undermining the economic plans of the United States in Iraq or in other places. In essence, what that means is that if you're opposed to the war, you're engaged in political activity which challenges U.S. foreign policy or U.S. Imperial policy or capitalist exploitation in any location, you may then become a candidate for having all of your rights suspended and for your bank account to be seized, your home to be taken, your car to be confiscated. And the executive order actually states that if anyone were to try to assist you in these circumstances, i.e. if your brother or your cousin or your friends tried to allow you to transport yourself someplace or to go to a doctor or a dentist, they too would be then folded under this order. And that order is all-encompassing July 17th.
I'd like to remind our listeners about the telephone number to call, and we'll soon go to some of your calls. 212-209-2900 is the WBAI number to call to reach us. First, I'd like to mention that tomorrow in New York at the United States Courthouse, 500 Pearl Street, Courtroom 20B, the ACLU is challenging the constitutionality of the National Security Letter section of the Patriot Act and is asking each and every one of you to attend. What their challenge, what the National Security Letter provision does is it authorizes the FBI to demand records without prior court approval. That means if you receive a National Security Letter, the FBI can forbid you or gag you from telling anyone about the record demand. Now, this is very similar to what Ralph is talking about the powers of the government. So you're not even allowed to tell people that the government is investigating you. That is what the gag provision means, and the ACLU is challenging it, and an internet provider who has to remain anonymous because of this gag order is the subject of this case. So please show up tomorrow, 500 Pearl Street. It's at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. This is in New York. It's 500 Pearl Street, Courtroom 20B in the United States Courthouse. Michael, do we have anyone on the line? Okay, let's go to our first caller.
Hello?
Thank you for calling. You're on WBAI.
Oh, I was wondering if you could tie this into the state of activism, like what these procedures or new potential rules, how it might affect the state of activism?
Well, obviously, any activity in opposition to U.S. policy qualifies under the July 17th injunction. And what's instructive about that is that if you look at the recent capitulation of the Democratic Party and its leadership to the demands by the Bush administration for total latitude in spying on anybody and in monitoring phone calls and monitoring emails and monitoring all communications. These were by way of providing not just information but a database, and the database is for designating people for what? For detention. So, in essence, the days of action or any mobilization against U.S. policy, U.S. imperial policy, the genocide in Iraq, opposition to the privatization of all resources, notably oil in Iraq, and handing them over to U.S. corporations and companies, the ABCs of resistance to imperial exploitation of peoples overseas and at home, it qualifies us for the repressive treatment that these measures spell out. Yes.
But, Ralph, it's a matter of political cost. We were discussing this just last week. Soon after this executive order referring to the U.S. plans in Iraq, there was an announcement that Chevron was interested in oil exploration in the further privatization of the Iraqi oil fields. And there was a demonstration organized here in San Francisco against Chevron. It was at the Chevron headquarters. And these demonstrators demonstrated freely. Technically, according to this executive ruling, they could be arrested. They could be detained. It's a matter of political cost. Is the administration going to come down on these demonstrators against Chevron at this point? No, they aren't. It is, as you so eloquently had said to the person who was asking about this at the time, Ralph, it is a matter of political cost. So the more we demonstrate, the more active we are, the cost is higher for the government to do something to oppose us.
Yes, well, in essence, the operative question is, what can an isolated gangster regime actually pull off? The more that they threaten and the more they bluster and the more they demonstrate their panic, the more they indicate their isolation. And there is a broad, generalized disaffection in this society, not only amongst those of us who come out to manifest this in demonstrations as such, a deep disaffection from people who don't see a way forward, don't see a way out, but are not reconciled to the status quo. And in essence, yes, days of action, of course, qualify any of us for the repression that they've outlined here. But that's not new, and that's not going to go away.
Next caller, thank you for calling. The number is 212-209-2900. Again, 212-209-2900. Okay, so we'll continue. Talking about activism, on July 26th, there was an article in Global Research, Military to Crack Down on North American Union Protesters. And this was in reference to the Security and Prosperity Partnership meeting that took place in Montebello, Quebec, and that's going to take place August 20th and 21st. And it is going to be policed, surprisingly, or I should say not so surprisingly, by American forces along with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the RCMP, as well as the Sûreté du Québec. And the municipality, however, has refused to rent a community center to Council of Canadians Action Group. And they were wanted to hold a meeting at their community center, which is 6 kilometers away from the meeting that's taking place in Montebello. Yet the municipality refused to let this advocacy group hold its meeting. Furthermore, the Council of Canadians was told that in addition to having a 25-kilometer perimeter around the meeting place for these heads of state, in other words, nothing taking place within that 25-kilometer perimeter, that there were going to be checkpoints in nearby areas, and vehicles carrying more than 5 people will be turned back. That is martial law.
Well, I referred before to the San Francisco Examiner's 1983 series by Newt Royce. Now, interestingly, that was followed up by an article about how plans for martial law that had been applied to Vietnam War protests and Iran-Contra have now metastasized. And as an example of that, and this is also cited in Wikipedia, the following exchange is published between Representative Brooks. This is during the Iran-Contra hearings. You recall, brothers and sisters, that in Iran-Contra, what was exposed was that there was a money laundering scheme to sell arms to in Iran as a way of raising money to then send illicit arms to the Contras in Nicaragua, and what they were basically doing was running arms in and running cocaine out. Now, during the hearings, the chair was the Democrat from Hawaii, Senator Inouye, and one of the exchanges between Oliver North and the committee went as follows. Representative Brooks, Colonel North, in your work at the National Security Council, you were assigned to work on plans for continuity of government. And Senator Inouye intervenes. That question touches upon a highly sensitive classified area. I request that you do not touch on that. Brooks is undeterred. I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read even in Miami papers and several others that plans were developed by that same agency to suspend the American Constitution. I am deeply concerned about it. Is that the area on which you work, Colonel North? I want to get your confirmation, Senator Inouye. May I most respectfully request that this matter not be touched upon. If you wish to get into this, arrangements can be made for an executive session. So they didn't want the Democrats to allow that to be heard. But Brooks was persistent, and he cited the Miami Herald article of July 5th, 1987, that reported that the deputy of former FEMA director Louis O. Giuffrida, John Brickerhoff, handled the martial law portion of the planning. The plan was similar to the one entitled Rex 84, which Giuffrida had developed earlier to, quote, combat a national uprising. It provided for the detention, again here, of at least 21 million African Americans in assembly centers and relocation camps. Following a request by the Pentagon in January 2002 that the United States military be allowed the option of deploying troops on American streets, the Answer Institute for Homeland Security published a paper by Brinkerhoff that argued for the necessity of this. And in fact, the full facts and contents of the Reagan National Plan allowed for, specifically under an executive order, 13233, mass detention and the incarceration of untold thousands of people here. Of course, 21 million is cited with respect to African Americans across the U.S. It has indeed been a question of each administration, and these plans have indeed metastasized. FEMA camps, martial law, indefinite detention without trial all preceded the Patriot Act, Democrats and Republicans alike.
Great. Hello. Hello?
Hello,
you're on the air, WBAI.
Yeah, Ralph Shulman, please.
Yes, you're on the air with Ralph Shulman and Mike Shulman.
Yeah, I listen to you all the time, and I'm just wondering, I've heard you with your tirades against the State of Israel. I'm just wondering, do you find any self-redeeming value in the State of Israel at all? Or should Israel perhaps not exist?
No, I don't. There's
no self-redeeming value in Israel.
The Israeli state, as we've so often described and discussed on Taking Aim, is a colonial settler state predicated upon the eradication of the indigenous population in an orgy of ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, I've heard
the structure
that
of the state is no different in that respect from the South African apartheid state itself.
Oh, sure. Right.
And indeed, in fact, look at the law that the Israeli
state
has...
The only other country worse than Israel, I guess, is the United States.
Well, let's address the question of Israel.
Since you're concerned about it,
why don't we look at that concretely?
Listen to me a moment.
Just hear me out. And
you answered my question. You told me there is no self-redeeming value in the State of Israel.
No, of course, and no colonial settler regime.
Are you Jewish, Ralph?
By origin, yes.
What does it mean by origin?
I have no religious convictions.
Do you deny your heritage? Do you deny your Jewishness?
I have no religious convictions. Of course, I do not deny that my parents are Jews, and we have Jewish cultural affiliations and what have you, but we have no religious convictions.
Are you ashamed of being of Jewish heritage?
Where does this go?
Our program is not an avenue for argument. Let us say that there is a fundamental principle by which we abide, and that is democracy. And the true nature of democracy is that it is not
a function of
your ethnic or religious
affiliation that determines rights.
It's not race. It's not gender. It's not religious affiliation. It's not whether you believe in God or you don't believe in God. It's not your nationality. Each and every person deserves the same rights. And we believe that is the fundamental principle. We would not ask less for other people than we demand for ourselves. And if you start from that very simple principle, which is a basis of the Bill of Rights, it's a very fundamental principle, then ask yourself what you think of Israel, which is, by definition, a state for Jews. So let's go on to the next question, Next caller, Michael.
Yes, hello?
Hi, you're on the air. This is Ralph Shulman and Maya Shulman. You're on WBAI.
Thank you for the rare opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you.
As I was on the phone, of course, I heard clicks and staticky noise, and I'm thinking, well, that's not a very good phone tap, but since they are legal, and this is my first question, I will have a second question, please. Am I, under the current existing law, as you have been discussing, by my simply calling you and speaking with you, do I fall under the category of someone who is acting in a detrimental way towards the interests of the United States?
Well, that's what this, the July 17th executive order sets forward. And, of course, the interesting thing about this passage of legislation by the Congress, which allows for unlimited spying and tapping of phones and harvesting of information that's derived from monitoring emails and telephone communications, is that the arbiter of this was Michael McConnell, the Director of National Intelligence. And that the Democratic leadership was addressing itself specifically to Michael McConnell for his approval of what language would be used in legislation and what legislation, in fact, would be approved. When anything was submitted that McConnell did not agree to or accept, the Democrats immediately altered the language to conform to the requirements of the Director of National Intelligence. So, in essence, what was being stipulated here is a modus operandum was that the Congress of the United States is not the agency which has determination of policy or legislation any longer. The executive is not to answer to the Congress. It's the Director of National Intelligence who is the arbiter. And the meaning of this legislation is that anybody, literally tens of millions of people, can be monitored and their information harvested and prepared as a way of determining who gets detained and who does not get detained. Sure, you can make a phone call to somebody, you can have a communication by email with somebody, and if you express dissidence or opposition to U.S. policy,
okay,
by their standards and by their criteria, you know, it's an old story. You were subversive or you security risk. This was the language of the 40s and 50s, and it's replicated here.
In the August 12th,
yes,
the Sunday, August 12th Washington Post, there's an article by John Warwick and Walter Pincus, How the Fight for Vast New Spying Powers Was Won, and they go into the relationship between Michael McConnell and Congress. And what they point out particularly is that the National Security Agency was concerned that 90% of global communications pass through wires, which today are fiber optics, and capable of carrying 6,000 calls in a strand. And the National Security Agency wanted to indiscriminately tap into this. Supposedly, they're looking for calls between people in the United States and people overseas, but we don't know what they're looking at because as the Associated Press reported today, with the Chronicle had the headline, Catch-22 Saves Wiretap Program, and it mentions that the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping program has a built-in feature that the Justice Department says will shield it from ever being challenged as unconstitutional, and that's what they call secrecy. In other words, any challenge faces the fact that the government will say, well, to answer that question harms the security of the state. So we don't know whether they're tapping internally or they're tapping overseas calls or they're just, you know, they're just garnering whatever information they can. Before we go on, I'd like to say this is WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM on your dial and on the internet, www.wbai.org. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. And today we have a call-in program, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State. The number to call is 212-209-2900. Did you have a further question?
Yes. I guess you answered my first question just by merely calling you, since you have expressed, both of you, shall we say, not favorable response to what the United States and other entities are doing.
Yes, we are very
I won't be able to point. I was just wondering if someone like myself, just by calling you, I'm on the blacklist.
Oh, we can't answer that.
Okay. Now my second question, I believe both of you, please don't mistake this. I'm not like the previous caller asking for an argument.
No, I understand that. I appreciate the call and the concern.
You will well understand my question.
I understand
how,
it perfectly.
How am I as a listener to know whether you, with all your references, all your citations, all your documentation, are not simply out there to really pacify the opposition? I mean, no offense by the question, but I believe both of you would understand the question.
Well, I'm not sure that I understand the question. I mean, pacify the opposition to the United States authorities? I don't think we want to pacify them.
To make people think, well, at least there's somebody out there, you know, working on the case.
Well, I don't think you've heard our message, because our message is organize. And
well, my question, as when Ralph pointed
and
out,
participate.
Wikipedia is filled with disinformation,
yes,
as well as true.
Yes.
Factual information.
Well,
Wikipedia is quite selective.
You
might understand that some people would question, are you simply drawing in people into the web? I mean, you know this has happened throughout the centuries.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're asking us, but let me try to express myself about how we see the struggle against arbitrary authority and the exploitation of this tiny handful of people that has usurped power in our society. Again, as we've often laid forward, it's 1% of the population that owns more than 95% of the rest of us combined. Robert Townsend, who was the former president of Avis and American Express, calculated that 5,000 people in the United States control what he called the commanding heights of the U.S. economy. They average about 14 corporate directorships per person. It's a little gangster clique. It's a ruling class. And as their ability to meet the needs of the vast majority of the people who live in our society and other societies disappears, as they're increasingly dependent on military production, on wars abroad, preemptive wars, and as they are increasingly pauperizing the mass of our people, their power becomes very precarious. So these desperate resorts to dictatorial measures are a reflection of the crisis of an isolated oligarchy. And they may visit great crimes upon our people, but they shorten the days of their sustaining that rule by so doing. Because they are the few, the tiny, isolated few, and we are the many. And if you want to understand, I think, historically, what gives rise to pre-revolutionary conditions, it's when the rulers begin desperate measures to sustain their rule, and then they become split amongst themselves about how wise it is to attempt this and how risky and self-endangering it is to seek to impose the very measures that we're discussing here. So I don't take... we feel that this is a source not of apprehension, but of confirmation of the criminal nature of this ruling class and of its desperation. And we don't mince words about this. A ruling class so ruthless, so violative of our rights, so totally incapable of meeting human needs, cannot be persuaded, it cannot be influenced, it cannot be pressured, it cannot be contained, it has to be overthrown. We have a whole legacy of revolutionary heritage on which to draw. God forbid, said Thomas Jefferson, we should ever be 20 years without a revolution, because the blood of tyrants is democracy's natural manure. We stand on that tradition. And we don't bend the knee to those who have this arbitrary power. We try to encourage those who hear us to feel confident in the fact that historically no isolated oligarchy like this can sustain itself for very long.
And, Ralph, we have been very specific about things people can do, whether we mention that we'd like to see all of you show up at the courthouse, the U.S. courthouse tomorrow, 500 Pearl Street, courtroom 20D, for the ACLU challenge to the constitutionality of the national security letter, or the efforts we had over the years to create a labor party here in the United States. As the saying always went, the bosses have two parties. We need one of our own. There are many things we can do in many ways to organize, to resist.
And we should keep in mind that almost every administration in the United States, Republican or Democratic alike, has put these plans into effect. In June 1997, the Director of Resource Management of the United States Army confirmed a memorandum relating to the establishment of a civilian inmate labor program under the control of the Department of the Army. And the document stated, enclosed for your review is the draft Army regulation on civilian inmate labor utilization and the establishment of civilian prison camps on military installations. Congressman Henry Gonzalez, who was a Democratic congressman at that time, stated, the truth is yes, we have these standby provisions, and the plans are in effect, whereby we will, in the name of stopping terrorism, this is 1997, evoke the military, arrest Americans, and put them in detention camps. There is nothing especially new about this. Every capitalist administration has anticipated the prospect of resistance to its draconian measures to sustain wars. And whether this was under Clinton that this, what I've just cited to you, the Hermes Press called it secret police concentration camps in June 1997. And here we are now, a decade later, describing executive order of July 17th of Bush, which is reprising exactly these preparations. So it's not just a question of calling, taking aim, or calling your grandmother, for that matter. It's a matter of having the right to think, to speak, to
organize,
and to function as a democrat in a democratic fashion. The right to have meetings, the right to publish articles, the right to have discourse, the right to oppose your government, the right to criticize.
Thank you.
Those things are at risk here. What does that tell you about the kind of society that puts them at risk?
The number to call is 212-209-2900. That is 2900. Michael, next caller.
Hello.
You're on the air with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. This is WBAI New York.
How you doing, Maya, Ralph? It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys.
Thank you.
If I'm not mistaken, Daniel Inouye was the president of one of the California universities when the most severe repression was happening in the 60s in relation to the anti-war protests. Am I mistaken?
I don't believe so. Senator Inouye was from Hawaii. He was a Japanese-American who had actually lost an arm during the Second World War. And
I stand corrected.
All the more appalling, therefore, that Inouye was lending himself to the same kinds of things that led to the, the incarceration of Japanese Americans under similar circumstances.
I stand corrected. I thought the last call was actually interesting. It was a healthy bit of cynicism because you have to ask yourself a few questions when you're dealing with a question like that, and that is, are they asking for money? What are they asking for you in your activism? And you have to use a little bit of intuition. The call prior to that, I'm an Italian Jew or of Italian Jewish ancestry myself. I have no time for Jewish supremacism or supremacism of any other ethnicity or race, and I will not argue with those people because there is no argument to be made.
I couldn't agree with
you more. It's irrational, and there's no convincing a person who has that ideology. Now, the question I want to ask you, and I will take the answer off the air, is I've been researching this for quite some time now, but I'm not quite sure who's pulling the strings. Is it the United States or is it Israel? Is the United States using Israel as a proxy, or has Israel become an entity that, in a sense, can control the hegemon at this point? And I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Sure,
about
this has been
thank
raised.
You very much.
No, thank you for the call. I appreciate what you had to say. What you the question you just posed about whether the Zionist lobby, the AIPAC, and the Israeli state are pulling the strings and Israel really controls U.S. policy has been raised by people like James Petras and Mearsheimer and others recently. Frankly, it's simply another variation of the idea that there's a good bourgeoisie and a bad bourgeoisie, and that you can account for U.S. imperialism by the manipulations and control of their subsidized stooges. I mean, the Zionist state and the Israeli apparatus is a murder apparatus that's been at the service of U.S. imperialism since it was installed in Palestine. The Mossad has been a key element of Central Intelligence Agency operations, notably in Africa and Central America and Latin America, death squad operations that have led to the implementation of the dirty war agenda in Argentina and in Brazil and Paraguay. There is no prettifying the Zionist state and what it represents or the role of the Mossad, and there is certainly a confluence of interest in particular around the category of terror, because the Zionist state was always defining any resistance on the part of the people that it dispossessed as terrorism, and always insisting that the war on terror was that which imperialism should embrace as its own, and putting forward in particular the plan to the Zionists in the late 1970s, a plan called Strategy for the 1980s, the author of which was a Mossad operative named Oded Yinon in a publication called Kivinum, that called for the fragmentation of each Middle Eastern country into its ethnic and religious components. And that whole notion of the category of terror was adopted by U.S. imperialism as its own with the collapse of the Soviet Union. But this is a $10 trillion state in the United States. The Zionist state has been subsidized since 1948, over $100 billion. It works out to about $30,000 for each Israeli citizen. They can't even break wind without the approval of U.S. imperialism. To suggest that somehow, if it weren't for the Zionists, the United States would not have invaded Iraq, would not be targeting 60 countries for preemptive war, would not be seeking to fragment Central Asia and Middle Eastern countries into ethnic and religious components, that, but for the Zionist control of finances for the political process, U.S. imperialism would not be doing these things. It's fatuous nonsense. U.S. imperialism was engaged in these types of operations for at least 100 years before the existence of the Zionist state. That is not, again, to minimize the sinister nature of the Mossad in relation to such things as 9/11, carrying out political assassinations in conjunction with U.S. intelligence.
In South Africa.
No, prop of South Africa, all of that is abundantly true. But no, I don't think it is at all credible. It's a species of, you see, it gives a left cover of a kind to an old notion that there is a liberal bourgeoisie that is preferable, Democrats or New Dealers or whatever, that will somehow not pursue these policies if supported, and that they the task is to push out the more reactionary bourgeoisie and to embrace the more liberal bourgeoisie. Unfortunately, this is without any basis in reality, as administration after administration is manifested.
Thank you for calling. Michael, is there another caller on the line?
Hi, Ralph and Maya.
You're on the air.
Thank you.
WBAI New York.
Thanks very much. I wanted to commend you for your response to the caller who had questions about your allegiance to the State of Israel. It was a wonderful explanation of how we all have to rise above our tribe and religion and whatever and really address what is human. I won't go any further. Just say thank you for that explanation. My question is this. I wondered if you could comment a little bit about the executive order of May, I believe, of this year, which says roughly that in a time of crisis, the executive branch will be the guarantor of the Constitution, not the Congress. And further, I wondered if you could sort of see how you see these dots connecting. You may have addressed this earlier. I've only been listening for the last 20 minutes or so, and if it's redundant, you needn't go there.
Please.
And thirdly, I wondered what you make of Mr. Rove's departure and what, if anything, you think that changes or has no effect. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks so much for the call. One quick point about the question of ethnic identity or Jewish affiliation and all of that. I think we should keep in mind that Israel adopted the laws of the Jewish National Fund that require that in order to own land or to work on land or to sharecrop it for that matter or to lease it, you've got to prove at least four generations of maternal Jewish descent. Suppose in the United States, in order for anybody to be entitled to own land or live on it or work on it or lease it, you had to show that you had no Jewish blood for at least four generations. Everybody would immediately grasp the racist nature of such a state that predicated itself upon such legislation. So it's absurd for people to talk about their Jewishness in relation to a state that is adopting the Nuremberg laws as its basic modus operandi. It's a question here of what the Jesuits call invincible ignorance. These people know what the Israeli state is, but they choose not to know. Now, with respect to the question of the May executive order and the role of the executive, it has been increasingly the position of administrations. The Bush administration has taken it to a new height, if you like, that the executive has virtual military and dictatorial authority, and that Congress cannot indeed impede it in this regard. And that, of course, undoes all of the constitutional arrangements that were designed to grant to the legislative power the authority to make policy and the executive the entitlement to implement it. Mind you, I think it's important for us to note that the American Revolution, which was made by the mass of farmers and artisans, was controlled by the property-owning class. And they opposed direct elections, and they made property criteria essential. And the Senate was not a direct election, and there was an electoral college and so on. And the democratic will of the mass of the population was constantly being impeded. And many of these separations between powers were designed to obstruct and to obviate the danger of the mass of our people having direct control over policy. It's the bourgeois nature of that particular revolution. Notwithstanding that, the restraints upon an arbitrary executive, which was in the minds of the property-owning rebels of the 18th century who led the American Revolution, or I prefer to say usurped the American Revolution, was to prevent arbitrary dictatorship, was to not to overcome the authoritarian and absolutist nature of the royal authority of King George III. And that is being swept away. In the crisis of American imperialism and capitalism, the fear that the sentiment amongst the population will begin to overwhelm their ability to control, they are doing away with the, if you like, the democratic facade, relentlessly and step by step, both parties, and without hesitation.
The National Security Directive to which you refer is found on the Internet, NSPD 51/HSPD 20, and it's called the National Security and Homeland Security Presidential Directive, which calls for the president to suspend the constitutional government and have broad dictatorial powers under martial law if he declares that there's, quote, a catastrophic emergency. And this ties into what we were saying about earlier about the ABC report of, quote, spectacular terror attacks in the United States this summer. So they are preparing, as Ralph has said, these are preparations that have been taken by administration going all the way back in history. And once again, you have here the Bush administration doing so. What is interesting is that you have the governors of the of various states coming together and the National Governors Organization coming together to oppose President Bush's mandate that that the federal government has more power and can control the National Guard in the states. The governors of each state do not want the federal government to take over their functions. Ralph?
Yes, but it's interesting. You see, let me point out that these moves towards executive dictatorial or arbitrary or total power come within a very specific context. Remember that at the time of Katrina, Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, in essence, martial law was declared in New Orleans. And the governor didn't want the executive to have control over the National Guard in that regard, but didn't oppose the application of martial law to the population. And the mayor of New Orleans embraced martial law in New Orleans on the basis of what? That the population was expecting to have food, that the population was expecting to have support, that the catastrophe of Katrina was not going to go unanswered by the population, and effectively martial law was declared. And by the same token,
on the basis of false reports of looting.
Yes, but the looting was only, as you say, Maya, the pretext, because they had already made those preparations long before any reports of looting, and they had 70,000 of these mercenaries, Blackwater mercenaries there, and the Army had made a declaration in the Army Times that New Orleans would be like Little Somalia. So just as you had in the Rex 84 and the FEMA preparations for the arrest of 21 million African Americans, so now with the crisis of the hurricane in New Orleans, the same operations were put into place. Similarly, with respect, we did a six-part program on the weaponization of biological agents and the prospect of mass epidemics.
Oh, actually, Ralph, it became eight parts.
Eight parts, you're right, Maya. And one of the things that constantly emerges here in this discussion of these executive orders about arbitrary military and martial law rule is that they will quarantine vast numbers of people. They will close down hospitals and access to the same, and that the outbreak of epidemics, which the authorities themselves are preparing, will be the occasion for these sorts of measures of martial law. Every way you touch the way the society functions in the present period demonstrates that they are constantly preparing for what Atlantic Monthly called the Armageddon Plan, where the country would be run by military out of bunkers virtually by military commanders, where the Northern Command is assigned control over every city within 200 miles of the coastline. The militarization of the society, the suspension of normal constitutional protections, the rounding up of people in mass detention camps, the declaring of U.S. citizens as enemy combatants, so-called, all of these things that delimit the ability for people to exercise the most elementary democratic rights are in place by all administrations. They haven't done it as such. They are, of course, constantly preparing and conditioning people for this kind of repression. But at the same time, they are deeply apprehensive about what happens next. Because you take the mask away from U.S. capitalism in the fashion in which they are preparing to do, and you set the stage for revolutionary transformation of the society and for mass struggle on a scale we've not seen before.
And on that note, Ralph, we'll conclude this edition of Taking Aim. This has been Taking Aim. Thank you all for calling. You can contact us by email, and we do respond right away at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's takingaim@pacbell.net. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today has been a call-in show, and we thank you all for participating on the subject of dictatorship and the dysfunctional capitalist state. Our webmaster, we hope all of you send good wishes, is in the hospital now, and there'll be a delay for our programs to be on our archive, which is at www.takingaimradio.com. But you'll find there over 5.5 years of programming. Meanwhile, please visit the WBAI archive, www.wbai.org, for this week's and the past couple of weeks' programs. We'll be with you next week. Pick it, no, the eye. When a ramato became our door out, pick it, no, the eye.